The headlines after days of escalating tensions. The Israeli regime bans non-Muslim visits to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound until the end of Ramadan. China says Taiwan's ruling party is endangering the island's peace and stability by colluding with outside powers. And Myanmar junta confirms carrying out airstrikes on a village in northeast of the country amid growing international calls for accountability. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour. Israel has halted visits by non-Muslims, including Jews, to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound until the end of the month of Ramadan. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made the announcement after a wave of unrest and condemnations over the regime's brutal attacks on Muslim worshippers at Islam's third holiest site. According to Palestine Information Center, Israeli forces have also been ordered to stop settlers from visiting the Al-Aqsa compound from Wednesday. Israel's far-right minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, has described Netanyahu's decision as a blatant mistake. Ben-Gvir has been on the forefront of supporting terrorism and incitement against the Palestinians. The resistance movement Hamas has called on Palestinians to mobilize and gather at Al-Aqsa during the last 10 days of Ramadan. According to a 1967 agreement, non-Muslims are allowed onto the site during visiting hours, but they are barred from any religious rituals there. The Israeli regime has halted visits of non-Muslims to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound until the end of the holy month of Ramadan. Earlier, our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandil joined us to tell us more about the issue.
It seems that Netanyahu doesn't want for the situation to complicate more. He wants to avoid, let's say, another war, whether on other lines, whether with the Gaza Strip, Lebanon, or even Syria. So that's why, according to experts, he took this decision to halt settler intrusions into Al-Aqsa Mosque complex until the end of Ramadan. This means also settler, as they consider tourist entry to the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So during the last 10 days of the holy month of Ramadan, if the Israeli regime, all of it, of course, accepted Netanyahu's decision, because ministers would disagree, of course, like Itamar Ben-Gvir, settlers are not allowed to raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. But there's still one problem for the Palestinians. This doesn't mean that Palestinians can freely enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We have to remind our viewers that people living in the occupied West Bank need special Israeli-issued permits in order to enter Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa. It's very difficult and sometimes it's impossible for people to obtain. However, on Fridays, Israel said it will allow men above the age of 50 and women of all ages only on Fridays to enter Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds.
Turkey's former intelligence chief has hailed Palestinian resistance groups for their deterrent powers against the occupying Israeli regime. Ismail Haki Pekin made the remarks while speaking to Iran Press, an international visual news agency in the Islamic Republic. He underlined that Palestinians were defenseless in the past, but resistance groups are now active in the Gaza Strip and Al-Quds to defend their land. He called Lebanon's Hezbollah movement the strongest arm of the axis of resistance. Further, Pekin highlighted the role Iran has been playing in support of the oppressed Palestinians. He said without Iran's backing, Palestinians would face genocide and forced expulsion from their ancestral land. He urged other neighboring countries to follow Tehran's policies to improve peace and stability in the region. Palestinian resistance groups have held a press conference in Gaza to highlight the latest developments in the occupied Palestinian territories. Our correspondent, Ola Wasi, was there and filed this report.
During the regular meeting, Palestinian resistance groups held a press conference in Gaza to address the latest developments in Palestine. They touched upon what they called a iconic steadfastness of the Palestinians in the occupied Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque in the face of the Israeli atrocities during the holy month of Ramadan. They called on the Palestinian people across the occupied territories to maintain their presence in the holy mosque, especially during the last 10 days of Ramadan.
We call on Palestinians to set out for Al-Aqsa Mosque and to intensify their presence in large numbers to abort the Israeli plans. We hold Israeli occupation accountable for any future escalation if the violations continue in the Holy Mosque.
The Palestinian resistance groups reflected on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's recent press conference, saying it exposed the fragility of the regime. They added, "His threats are not going to intimidate the Palestinians. Instead, it's going to be faced by more resistance actions."
We expect that we are heading to a bone-breaking battle with the Israel occupation, especially amid this vulnerability of the occupying regime. And Netanyahu's attempts to reflect this weakness through opening more fronts at his cabinet. This indicates that all options are available across all fronts against the Israel occupation.
Just days ahead of International Quds Day, the resistance groups held international support for the Palestinian cause, saying such efforts will foil the Israeli regime's plans to annex the Palestinian lands.
"As we observe the Quds Day, which represents a victory for Palestine, the Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, we salute the Arab and Islamic countries, the axes of the resistance, and on top of them the Islamic Republic of Iran, for their efforts and active role in supporting the Palestinian cause and backing the Palestinian resistance. We call on the Islamic nation and to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people against Israeli conspiracies."
Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza retaliated the brutal Israeli raid on the Al-Aqsa Mosque by rocket attacks, while Palestinians in the West Bank intensified their resistance against the Israeli forces. The Israeli occupation forces are escalating violence in the occupied Palestinian territories, especially during the holy month of Ramadan. Observers say the situation might explode at any point in the future. However, the Palestinian resistance say that they are committed to defend the Palestinian lands. Al Al-Asif, Gaza.
Elsewhere, Yemen and Saudi Arabia are set to exchange prisoners against a backdrop of rising hopes for peace after more than 8 years of Saudi-led war on its southern neighbor. A prisoner involving hundreds of detainees from both sides under a deal will last 3 days from Thursday. An official has been quoted as saying that nearly 900 prisoners will be flown between Yemen and Saudi Arabia. It's the biggest prisoner exchange since October 2020 and will be facilitated by teams and flights of the Red Cross. The agreement was struck days after a Saudi delegation held talks with Yemen's Ansarullah movement in Sana'a in a bid to discuss a permanent ceasefire. Riyadh and its allies launched a devastating war and blockade on the impoverished country back in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. The UN says hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have been killed since then. China says Taiwan's ruling party is putting the island's peace and stability at risk by joining hands with outside powers in a bid to gain independence.
The Democratic Progressive Party's collusion with external forces in seeking independence and provocation is the greatest threat to peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait. Without a stable situation in the Taiwan Strait and peaceful development of cross-strait relations, it will be impossible for Taiwan to have a stable and good environment for investment and business, which will directly affect the island's economic development and the vital interests of the Taiwanese people.
The spokeswoman for China's Taiwan Affairs Office also warned the island against challenging the One China principle. She said the DPP is also acting as a pawn of the United States. Beijing has been angered by the Taiwanese president's recent stopover in the U.S. on her way to and from Central America. Tensions mounted further after Tsai Ing-wen met with the U.S. House Speaker and expressed Taiwan's determination to defend freedom of democracy. Beijing considers Taiwan as part of its territory and is opposed to its nexus with the U.S. China also launched military exercises around Taiwan in reaction to Tsai's meeting with Kevin McCarthy. Meanwhile, Taiwan said 14 Chinese fighter jets have crossed the median line of the Taiwan Strait in the last 24 hours. Myanmar's ruling junta is facing international outcry over deadly airstrikes on a gathering in the northwestern Sagaing region. The junta has confirmed Tuesday's attacks, which reportedly claimed at least 100 lives, including children. The airstrikes targeted a ceremony in a village which the military claims was organized by opponents of the 2021 coup. UN Chief Antonio Guterres has strongly condemned the attack and urged those responsible to be held accountable. Several Western countries, including Germany and the U.S., have also reacted to the killings. The incident is the latest in a string of deadly raids by the junta since overthrowing an elected government. In March, more than 30 people were killed by the army at a monastery in southern Shan State. Round two of a strike by junior doctors has gotten underway in England, with some authorities calling it the most disruptive industrial action in the history of the National Health Service. It's the latest in a wave of public sector strikes over pay and conditions since last year. Syed Puduza reports from a picket line in central London.
The UK government calls their pay demands unrealistic, but these junior doctors say that's simply what they are worth. 4 days of strikes, with the government yet to come up with what the unions call a credible offer.
The strikes come in the wake of a four-day bank holiday weekend, causing a level of disruption unseen since public sector strikes began last summer. But the doctors here tell us they were left with no choice.
Junior doctors, all qualified doctors training to reach consultant level, account for about half of all physicians working within the NHS, with pay packets ranging between $36,000 and $71,000 a year. But pay, the doctors say, is one reason they're on the picket line.
The NHS is in crisis. We are in recruitment and retention crisis when it comes to junior doctors. At the moment, there are over 7 million patients on the NHS waiting list. And to put that into perspective, it's more than the entire population of Scotland. This is only going to get worse as junior doctors are leaving in their droves to countries where they feel better valued.
The British Medical Journal says last year alone, nearly 7,000 UK doctors applied for a certificate to work abroad, mainly in Australia, New Zealand and Canada. The British Medical Association, which represents doctors, is asking for a pay rise of 35%. The government says that pay demand is out of step with other settlements in the public sector and accuses the BMA of maintaining a militant stance. The striking doctors disagree.
We are being militant in what we want in terms of we want our voices to be heard, and we will demonstrate how integral we are to the NHS without doing so. So we were militant in ensuring a 72-hour strike as our first strike to really highlight how key junior doctors are at present to the NHS and to the future of the NHS.
A future that is now in doubt with a push for privatization. This week's action by junior doctors will mean an estimated 200,000 appointments, procedures, even time-sensitive cancer treatments delayed. This is the latest in a wave of industrial action by public sector workers in the UK, demanding pay hikes to match inflation that exceeds 10%. Underpaid, overworked, and demoralized, these doctors work for a National Health Service that's teetering, stricken by strikes and mired in dispute. Syed Puduza, London.
A batch of U.S. classified documents leaked on social media shows Washington has serious concerns about Ukraine's capacity to defend against Russia. One top secret document said tough Russian defenses and Ukrainian deficiencies in training and munition supplies will probably exacerbate casualties during offensives by Ukraine. Another secret document detailed the dire state of Ukrainian air defenses. The document said Kiev's ability to provide air defenses which protect the front line will be completely reduced by May the 23rd. Scores of highly sensitive documents have been circulating on social media for months, but only began to receive media attention last week. The U.S. is now trying to remove them. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says Washington will, quote, turn over every rock to find the source of the leak. The CIA director William Burns has also described the leak as deeply unfortunate, adding a quite intense investigation is going on to find its origin.
A new trove of classified U.S. military documents surfaced on social media in recent days. The disclosure marks Washington's worst national security breach in many years.
This century so far, we have seen four vast intelligence-related leaks. Cablegate, Chelsea Manning, then Snowden on NSA, then Vault 7 on CIA, and then again the Shadow Brokers, another NSA leak. This is number five in that series of major, highly damaging, highly embarrassing intelligence leaks. So I think we're looking at, you know, safe to say this is one of the most damaging intelligence leaks this century so far.
The leaked documents include details about Ukraine's lack of ammunition, U.S. intelligence methods used against Russia, and embarrassing evidence pointing to U.S. spying on close allies such as Ukraine, South Korea, and Israel. The White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said U.S. President Joe Biden had been informed of the breach late last week and was being kept informed of developments. However, when asked whether the leak has so far been contained and whether other documents have yet to be released, Kirby replied, "I don't know.
We don't know who's responsible for this, and we don't know if they have more that they intend to post. So we're watching this and monitoring it as best we can. But the truth and the honest answer to your question is we don't know. And is that a matter of concern to us? You're darn right it is."
The Pentagon has referred the leak to the Justice Department for criminal investigation. The documents have a range of classifications, including top secret and no foreign, which stands for not releasable to foreign nationals, suggesting the leaker is American. The documents were printed and folded, possibly to put in a pocket, before being photographed and uploaded. The release appears to be the most serious public leak of classified information in years, although it is believed to be much smaller in scale and scope compared to the 700,000 documents, videos, and diplomatic cables that appeared on the WikiLeaks website in 2013. A new trove of.
According to a new report, the recent leak of more than 100 secret U.S. defense documents could just be the tip of the iceberg. Some analysts believe that the U.S. could expect more damage to its reputation and its relations with its allies.
The leak features photographs of dozens of highly classified military and intelligence documents on the U.S. national security and its close allies, which have been surfacing on Twitter, Telegram, Discord, and other social media platforms over the recent days. The data reportedly includes secret information on the war in Ukraine, as well as sensitive analyses of U.S. key allies, including South Korea, Israel, and Ukraine. The documents contain a wide range of highly classified information, providing a rare window into how the U.S. spies on allies and adversaries alike. One document reveals that the U.S. has been spying on Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. "That is unsurprising," said a source close to Zelensky, but Ukrainian officials are deeply frustrated about the leak. Others reveal the degree to which the U.S. has penetrated the Russian Ministry of Defense and the Russian military contractor Wagner Group, largely through intercepted communications and human sources, which could now be cut off or put in danger. Yet another document describes in remarkable detail. Now, you might ask, what impact could the leak have? The impact of the leak could be significant, putting U.S. intelligence sources at risk while giving the country's foes valuable information.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Riza, peace be upon him, has said, If you are filled with joy when you are with us, the Ahlul Bayt, in the upper reaches of the heaven, then be sorrowful when we are sad, and be joyous when we are joyous.
Our fast-paced lives have been made possible by advanced technologies. On a broader scale, technology has changed major sectors over the past 20 years, including healthcare, telecommunication, energy, and so much more. And knowledge-based products in particular have increased safety, speed, and efficiency in manufacturing sectors. Productions in this field have brought numerous social and economic advantages while generating billions of dollars in revenue, making them indispensable for Iran's economic growth. Hello again and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. I'm your host Ali Reza Ikhtiarzadeh, and this week we're going to look at the activities of Iranian knowledge-based companies. We wanted to see how they help advance various industries and explore why their dedicated efforts are so important to the country. Plus, we will check out some of their contributions to the national economy as a whole. So, let's get started. We hear the phrase knowledge-based enterprise thrown around a lot these days, but some might be wondering what we mean by a knowledge-based company. Interestingly, there is no agreed-on definition because of the broad range of their activities. However, they all have one thing in common. They use intangible assets such as intellectual property and depend heavily on innovation as a competitive source. To get a clearer idea of knowledge-based enterprises, we visited one in Semnan province to understand what they do. With decades of experience, this company specializes in making various types of gas turbines, blades, and parts. All production here begins in the design room. Based on requirements, parts are designed, then a prototype is created using wax. Later, the wax models are used to create precise molds, which are then cast with metal. It produces products along the lines of exports, meaning that all production stages strictly follow national and international standards for quality and safety, making them compatible with international regulations and ready for market destinations abroad. Items manufactured here are used to make gas turbines. It supplies equipment to Iran's national gas distribution grids, which feed gas to cities, oil refineries, power plants, and other industries through pipes that stretch across the country. You might find it interesting that these advanced services and technologies were previously imported. This means there was a certain dependency on foreign companies to get such items, which created a lot of expensive complications. Knowledge-based companies such as the one we just mentioned are among the pioneers of indigenizing this technology, saving the country millions of dollars on imports. The beating heart of any knowledge-based company is its research and development department. Here, new products are created after vast amounts of studies. It is where science and knowledge meet method and production. It is also the place where the quality of products is put to the test. But it's not just a single room. This company has dedicated vast amounts of space to these activities, which also house advanced lab technology and testing equipment. Generally speaking, knowledge-based companies employ specialists and university graduates that handle important tasks. These individuals are the glue or the bridge between knowledge and production. Highly skilled and expert staff is one of the main advantages of this competitive market. Like many businesses across the country, this firm has overcome many obstacles to enjoy its numerous achievements. One such challenge has been the US-imposed sanctions. However, it has come up with its own unique approach, which has turned this obstacle into a massive opportunity. All things considered, there are numerous investment opportunities in this production field, particularly regarding research and development of products that do not currently exist in the market. This knowledge-based company has never stopped eyeing the future. It plans to expand its product list and optimize its production while improving items it already manufactures.
The company we just talked about is one part of the giant puzzle that makes up the knowledge-based industry. The government has supported the shift to a knowledge-based society for decades, yet this shift has been more apparent in recent years. Such support has paved the way for boosting innovation and scientific progress, leading to many economic advantages.
In 2010, Iran passed several laws promoting and supporting these enterprises, strengthening a legal framework for the growth of the knowledge-based ecosystem. These efforts have paid off in many ways. Since 2013, knowledge-based companies and startups have grown over 140-fold to 7,000 active units today. These firms make thousands of specialized technologies that have massively reduced the country's dependency on foreign imports. Moreover, these businesses have increased developments in the production of medical devices, energy, agriculture, ICT, aircraft maintenance, mining, petrochemicals, biotechnology, and so much more. In fact, Iran also exports a lot of specialized products. According to figures from the National Innovation Fund, tech firms and knowledge-based companies raked in over $5 billion in revenues last year. In total, presently, Iran's knowledge-based ecosystem accounts for more than 3% of the country's gross domestic product. That's going off of statistics from the Vice Presidential Office for Science and Technology. So far, the government has implemented numerous policies and plans to help support knowledge-based companies over the years. These schemes include loans with low interest rates, tax exemptions, and easing commercial license issuances. The goal is to encourage the development of Iran's tech ecosystem and boost lucrative, high-tech productions for exports. Iran is no stranger to the handwoven carpet market. Traditionally, the country has been weaving carpets for millennia with skills passed down through generations, some even as highly protected family secrets. Iranians were among the pioneers of weaving carpets, and with years of experience, they have achieved a great deal of perfection in this arena. The craft has represented Iran's rich culture and heritage for centuries and has been adored all over the world. Our quest for answers led us to the 29th International Exhibition of Handmade Iranian Carpets. This event is viewed by many industry participants as the world's largest handmade carpet expo when it comes to quantity and quality. Visitors were dazzled by thousands of handwoven carpets in all sorts of contemporary and traditional design patterns. The exhibition is a place for national and international trade and commercial envoys to visit in order to size up the market and make business deals. All sorts of carpets are found here that were brought in from all corners of Iran, including very rare rugs. We caught up with a few vendors to see what type of activities they carry out. A high-quality Iranian carpet can cost thousands of dollars, with antique rugs fetching even higher prices. There is so much variety to choose from the floral designs of Isfahan to the intricate fine details of Qom carpets and the strong compact bijar rugs made in Western Kurdish villages. The list goes on and on. However, most carpets are not valued based on knot count, but rather because of their materials, design, and overall size. While some rug varieties follow specific designs, most are entirely improvised, with the weaver adding traditional motifs and their personal design touch to the carpet. Handwoven with the finest materials, including wool and silk, a single Persian rug can often take years and sometimes decades to create. Most handwoven carpets are produced in rural areas. Furthermore, women make up the majority of carpet weavers and produce raw materials such as silk and wool in rural areas. Such collectives safeguard the rights and income of weavers who frequently receive the least profit from their products. This is mainly due to numerous middlemen businesses that make money from carpets. Cooperatives also serve another purpose. They organize the production chain by linking material producers with weavers and buyers to complete a production cycle. The massive exhibition is one of the best places to get a bird's eye view of this thriving market. Yes, ironically, one of the biggest importers of Iranian handmade carpets used to be the United States. This is followed by European countries. However, owing to the US-imposed sanctions, Americans were forced to find alternate avenues to satisfy their cravings for these highly coveted carpets. For centuries, the Iranian carpet has represented the country's rich culture and art. Its stunning design and exquisite quality have turned the ancient craft into a lucrative commodity sought after by many across the world. But Iran's handwoven carpet exports have also seen numerous ups and downs over the decades. Industry participants say the US sanctions tried to pull the rug out from under the Persian carpet legacy. But the move didn't work and only seems to have increased the world's demand for these items. 1994 was the golden period for Iranian handwoven carpet exports. Back then, exports peaked at over $2 billion. Later down the road, the US imposed a ban on Persian rugs in 2010. After signing a 2015 nuclear deal, the ban was lifted only to be reimposed after Washington unilaterally pulled out of the accord in 2018. That's also around the time when cheap knockoffs of Persian rugs made by Asian countries began flooding the market. Either way, authentic handwoven rugs from Iran still hold their place in the market despite roller coaster exports. The industry is gradually bouncing back. According to Iran's Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines and Agriculture, the country still maintains first place in exports of handwoven carpets worldwide. Based on figures from the National Customs Administration, exports of handwoven carpets increased to nearly 85% in terms of value in the first 2 months of 2021 alone. According to the National Carpet Center of Iran, last year, the country exported some $64 million worth of these items. Also, production went up after the coronavirus pandemic as many craftspeople who had left the sector returned, causing a production jump of around 400%. All right, while I take a quick little break here, I'll be back shortly. Hey everyone, welcome to another special feature of Bazaar. I'm your host Ali Reza, and today we're checking out a knowledge-based company that is saving the country around $20 million worth of imports annually by managing to produce inhaler capsules that we use to import from foreign countries through in-house knowledge, research, and technology. Stay tuned to find out how they did it. Patients with asthma or dyspnea need to use inhalers to get the prescribed drug into their lungs. That requires not just the active substance of the drug, but also a sort of carrier to take the drug into your lungs before it is fully absorbed in your mouth, before it even gets down your trachea. You will find them mixed with the active substance in inhaler capsules that the inhaler punctures once you put the capsule in, which then you inhale.
Our journey begins in the storage room where they bring in the raw material, the active substance for these inhaler capsules in the form of tiotropium bromide. Now, this company produces 45 million of these inhaler capsules annually for the 150 to 200,000 patients in the country that are prescribed to use them. And they use not more than 1 kilogram of this active substance, this tiotropium bromide, to make all of these. Now let's check out the production line to see how it's actually made. The raw material in the form of a small amount of tiotropium bromide, as well as the excipients, which would be the aforementioned carriers that mix with the active substance, are then sent to the production line along with the gelatin capsules themselves, which would later be filled with our formulation substance, the mixture of our active substance and the excipients. So before we get into the actual production line, first they bring the raw material from the storage room to allocate, to determine what amount of each formulation material they need to bring into the production line. So that includes the active substance, the aforementioned tiotropium bromide, and the excipients, which is the additive substances. So once they've allocated the necessary amount of those, they bring it to the production line, which we will check out now. Perhaps the biggest challenge in this production line is the mixing of an infinitely small amount of active substance with the excipients to get a completely uniform mixture of our formulation substance that you would find inside the capsules. The production line would have to be sensitive enough to mix 18 micrograms of tiotropium bromide with 10 milligrams of excipients in a completely uniform way. 1 microgram, by the way, is 1/1000th of a gram. There's actually very little substance in it. And that is because the capsule filling machine is capable of microdosing, which after we bring the formulated powder from the previous process, this machine can fill this container, this little capsule, with just 10 milligrams worth of powder, formulated powder, which is not a capability that a lot of capsule filling machines are capable of. So once this capsule is filled with our 10 milligrams worth of formulated substance, we then go to the container filling room.
The containers that have been filled with exactly 30 capsules are brought to be labeled, then packaged, to be sent back into the warehouse, to be sent to pharmacies, and get in the hands of patients. But before that happens, they need to go through one final stage of quality assurance. Because this company has managed to fully domesticize the production technology of this particular product, they're able to save 90% of the currency that would otherwise be spent on procuring this very product for the patients in the country through imports. That is $9 million worth of savings, and they're fully capable of doing that because their production line allows for even leftover for exports. Because of the competitive pricing of the aforementioned tiotropium bromide capsules, the value of the potential exports of this product is estimated to be around $30 million.
And now we're at the quality control lab, and one of the most important quality control procedures that they do is to test the actual performance of the formula and the capsule. So what they do is they use a regular inhaler as a normal patient would. They would insert the capsule in it and use the lung simulator. So they would insert the inhaler, and with the help of a vacuum pump attached to this flow regulator attached to the simulator itself, they simulate the flow of a normal human inhale and see how much of the formula is administered to different stages of the lung. Each of these circles has these holes on them, which gets exponentially smaller the lower you go, to the point that at the bottom you don't really even see any of these holes. And the residue left by the formula through this inhale, we test out to see how much of the formula is left on each stage, and then we would see whether the residue left is to the it measures up to the amount that we wanted it to, and that pretty much concludes the test, the performance test for our formula. And that also pretty much concludes this episode of Boaz Earth. Take care and bye-bye. For our final portion of the program, let's check out some news and trends in the knowledge-based industries. The activities of knowledge-based companies are not just limited to Iran's borders. They have also headed to Venezuela to kick off a tech and science fair showcasing Iran's latest technological achievements.
Nearly 80 Iranian firms participated alongside hundreds of Venezuelan companies in the fair. They offered products and services in numerous fields such as oil, gas, health, pharmaceuticals, agriculture, and machinery. The goal is to exchange experiences, knowledge, and services and deepen Iran's trade ties with the Latin American country. The expo was launched by Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. During the ceremony, Maduro announced that four fuel-efficient Iranian car models would be assembled in his country and released into the Venezuelan market.
One trend we are seeing these days is the increased activity of biotech companies. In fact, right now, knowledge-based products from this sector hold 40% of the country's total pharmaceutical exports to show for it.
That's based on the Association of Manufacturers and Exporters of Medical Biotechnology Products. Biotech refers to the use of living systems and organisms to develop products. According to the association, these products have saved the country millions in foreign exchange. Additionally, these knowledge-based companies have made Iran self-sufficient in biotech production. This sector exports its products to European, Asian, and Latin American countries while competing with other items in the international arena.
That covers our program for today. On behalf of the entire Bazaar team, thank you for tuning in and bye for now. Until then.
Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Brothers, sisters, my dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatihi wa barakatuh. Welcome to Keys of Life, Mafatihul Hayat, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. We are still trying to turn the first key on, which is food. Now, let's continue with that key and hopefully we open the door in this regard. Now, we're talking about food and what we should do with our food. Previously, we were talking about the fact that the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam insisted and emphasized on the fact that we need to eat together, not alone. And he said the blessings of Allah is in eating alone. The Ahlul Bayt take this notion of eating alone a bit seriously, and they start to use like very harsh words. So keep them in mind. Al-Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salamullah. He's narrating a hadith from his grandfather. He says, the Prophet said, La'ana Rasulullah thalath. The Prophet cursed three people. One of them, he says, Al-Akilu zadahu wahda. He who eats his food alone is cursed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, I know what you're thinking, saying, but Sayyid, where am I going to get people to eat with me? Or I'm alone in the house. You see, Ibrahim alayhi salam, it was known one of his traits and one of his character is that whenever they prepare a meal for him, he would go outside and stand in the middle of the road. And he were whoever he sees, he would say, come eat with me. Even if the person says, Ya Nabiullah, I am full. He says, it's okay. Just come with me and just eat a bit. So he never ate alone. And even there's a beautiful story about Ibrahim alayhi salam that one day he brought a person in and the person did not say Bismillah or did not thank Allah. And Ibrahim got really angry. He said, how could you, how dare you eat the food of Allah? Never mention his name. And the guy said to him, sorry, Mr. Ibrahim, but I am an atheist. I do not believe in God. And Ibrahim got really angry and he kicked the man away. Allah said to Ibrahim, Ibrahim, what did you do? He said, oh Allah, this guy does not believe in you. He said to him, Ibrahim, he does not believe in me, but I sustain him. I maintain him. I give him food. I give him everything. Who are you to kick him away? Then Ibrahim felt very bad about it. He ran after the man and he apologized to that man. The idea here is we need to make sure there's someone with us. So if you're in the house, there's someone in the house, ask them to come sit with you, eat a little bit. I mean, even today is maybe you live in a country where there's no Muslims around you to invite. But try your best to have someone eat with you. If the circumstances are too difficult to have a person sit with you, then obviously we can't say this hadith applies. But it applies to people who can and they refuse to. So the Prophet cursed those who eat their food alone. It is also narrated that Imam Ridha alayhi salam, every time they bring his meal for him, he never eats alone. He would bring his slaves and he would bring his servants, even bring the guy that's standing at the door. And he says, come eat with me. And he would have them all sitting with him. So you have an imam, an immaculate, infallible imam, divine personality, sits with his servants and he's eating a meal with them because he refuses to eat alone because he would remember that his grandfather said, Allah cursed he who eats alone. So he would bring his servants to eat. So when it comes to eating alone, then we are being told not to do so. So keep that in mind. It's always best to have people eating with you and not eating alone. Let's take a short break and then we will be back.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih ul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih ul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree,
امام اونطوری که اینو گفته دارم گفته دیگه. اون امامش گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره، همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Keys of Life, Mafatihul Hayat. We're looking at food and how we should eat our food and with whom should we eat our food. Now, let's change the topic in eating food. Now, you're sitting on the meal. There are people with you because you want the blessing and the barakah to be in this meal. How should you approach your meal? Now, should you eat from the front of the plate, the middle of the plate, from the sides of the plate? Should you be taking food from around you, from your, you know, next door friends who are sitting on the meal? Or how is it done? Now, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam says, إِذَا وُرِعَتْ الْمَائِدَةُ بَيْنَ يَدَيَ الرَّجُلِ. When a meal are placed in front of a person, فَلْيَأْكُلْ مِمَّا يَلِيهِ, then let him eat from that which is in front of him. وَلَا يَتَنَاوَلْ مِمَّا بَيْنَ يَدَيْ جَلِيسَهِ, and do not put your hand and take from the plate of the person next to you. وَلَا يَأْكُلْ مِنْ ذَرْوَةِ الْقِصْعَةِ, and let him not eat from the far side of the plate. Okay, so which means you have to eat from in front of you. فَإِنَّهُ مِنْ أَعْلَاهُ تَأْتِي الْبَرَكَةِ. So he says from the top and down, that's where the blessings come. From far, from the other side of the plate, there is no barakah. Okay? And then the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam says, إِذَا أَكَلْتُمُ الثَّرِيدِ فَكُلُوا مِنْ جَوَانِبِهِ. If you want to eat this thareed food, which we explain later is bread and meat and soup mixed together, he said, if you want to eat it from the edges that is in front of you. فَإِنَّ الذَّرْوَةَ فِيهَا الْبَرَكَةِ. For these sides is where the most blessings are found. Okay, now, this is in terms of eating. We have to eat from in front of us, not to eat from the sides, and not to start saying, give me this and give me that, and then we start to take from the place around us where others are sitting. Well, obviously, this is not the akhlaq of eating. So keep that in mind. Don't eat alone. Eat with people and eat from the food that is in front of you, and eat from the beginning of the plate, not in the middle, not from the sides, and don't take from the food of the people around you. These are the akhlaq. One more, let's mention before we call it a day. When it comes to sitting on the meal, obviously there are also adequates and morals and values we need to maintain. Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salamullah, he says, إِذَا جَلَسَ أَحَدَكُمْ عَلَى الطَّعَامِ. When one of you sits on a meal, فَلْيَجْلَسْ جَلْسَةِ الْعَبْدِ, let him sit the sitting of a servant, because we are sitting on the meal that's provided to us by Allah, him being a king, we are being a servant. So we have to respect the meal that we are eating. And he says, some people, they would cross their legs as they're eating. He says, do not do that. Don't cross your legs when you're eating. And don't sit and fold your legs one on top of the other, and you sit in a way where it is in the shape of a square. So crossing legs on top of each other, or just making them in that square shape that we usually do when we sit. And he says, فَإِنَّهَا جَلْسَةٌ يَبْغُضُهَا اللَّهُ عَزَّ وَجَلَّ وَيَمْقُتُ صَاحِبَهَا. For this kind of sitting, crossing your legs and folding them together, he says, this is a way or sitting Allah hates, and hates those who do it. So you say to me, how should I sit then? The way that the Prophet used to sit, he would put one feet under him. He would sit on one feet, and he pulls the knees of the other feet close to his chest. So you've seen people sit like that, where the one feet is under them and one feet is up, and it's closer to the chest. That's how we should sit and eat. We leave it here, and inshallah, we will continue in other episodes. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.